This is Richard Starkings, writer of Elephant Man from Image Comics, and you're listening to 15 Minutes with Mark Waid.
Welcome back to 15 Minutes with Waid.
I'm Mark Waid.
I'm Daphna.
And we're here broadcasting. I know you like that term. From the, what would be the...
Podcasting?
Podcasting, really... I suppose. Okay. Yeah. All right. We're here podcasting from the Boom Studios. See, she doesn't like the chair. I had this chair in the office.
It's really, really... It's not disturbing. Disturbing's not the word I'll use.
People find it a little disturbing. It's basically the same exact chair you would find in an interrogation office.
Literally. It's metal-rimmed, bad, like upholstery sort of coming apart because a suspect's been beaten on it too many times.
So I decided long ago that maybe dangling a pair of handcuffs off the side of the desk would be a way to...
It's so intimidating.
I know.
It's so intimidating.
Everyone sort of remarks on it and it's to the point where perhaps I should take the handcuffs off. But whatever will I do with handcuffs? Then I have no idea, he said ingenuously. All right, so what are we talking about today? We're talking about unknown.
We are talking about the unknown.
The unknown, a little pet project of mine. So, and when I say pet project, I mean something I came up with about an hour and a half before the solicits were due. But
you know, all the best ideas come that way.
Is that true?
Because you're not building up the expectation for yourself. Mm-hmm. It's like, as an ex-student, I speak with quite a lot of knowledge.
Yeah.
My best papers are the ones I've given all hope of ever putting my all in.
Right.
And somehow you skate through right under the wire and you feel like you got away with murder. And
there's something very freeing and very unintimidating about it. It's true. And so basically it was the night before the solicitations were due. All good comic book stories are created that way. And
Tell them the pitch. The pitch is awesome.
The pitch I love. The pitch was, she is Sherlock Holmes for the 21st century. Her name is Catherine Allingham. She is the world's greatest detective, and everybody knows it. She has the social skills of a filing cabinet, but that's all right. She's, you know, she knows the clues. She's brilliant.
Are you telling me she's stacked like a filing cabinet?
No.
Sorry.
You and your sexist comments. And she hires an assistant. The guy's over the moon. This is great. I get to work with Catherine Allingham. I'm a bit of a detective. This will be great. I can learn a lot of stuff. Nobody's ever worked with her before. Nobody's ever been an assistant. He takes the job. The first day on the job, she tells him two things. One, I have 6 months to live. And two, I refuse to go to my grave without first finding out the answer to the ultimate mystery, which is what happens when you die. So let's go find out. And so the assistant is now looking at her like, oh my God, she's crazy woman. You can't solve these problems with science. But you know what? That's the challenge of the series. And frankly, I bet you can.
But tell them the elevator pitch, because that was awesome when we saw it on the, like when you told Matt.
Yeah.
The so-and-so meets so-and-so. Oh, I don't want to spoil it because it's great.
Doc Savage as done by David Lynch.
Yes.
That was the pitch. That's Doc Savage by David Lynch. I really, when I was a kid, I got a bunch of Doc Savage. It was 1975, so I was like 12, and the Doc Savage movie was coming out with Ron Ely. These words mean nothing to anybody under the age of 40. He's a unique actor in that he has portrayed three American icons on the screen. He was Tarzan for television. He was Doc Savage for the movies, and he played Superman on TV once. Oh. He actually didn't play. He wasn't called Superman. He played in the Adventures of Superboy TV show. He was in an alternate reality where he was the grown up Superboy. So they literally couldn't say the word Superman. So he was basically the adult Superboy. So that is Ron Ely's claim to fame. But anyway, so and the Doc Savage the movie comes out is terrible. But I didn't know. I was 12. And so I was getting interested in Doc Savage, who is this pulp adventurer from the 1930s. It was the precursor of Superman. He was not the Man of Steel. He was the Man of Bronze. And actually, Superman took a few things. The Superman legend took a few things from Doc Savage, like Man of Bronze becomes Man of Steel. And Doc Savage was the first guy to have an Arctic fortress of solitude. So they just sort of swiped that cold. Anyway, the whole idea was he was a brilliant detective and a brilliant adventurer, and he would crisscross the world on these wild, crazy adventures. And so I read a couple of these when I was, 12 or whatever, and I really liked them. And so what happened to me is the same thing that happens to a lot of people around Christmas time, which is that you know, your parents know you're into this stuff, so they tell the aunts and they tell the uncles and they tell the grandparents, and before you know it, at Christmas time, I got like 75 Doc Savage novels. You can't read 75 Doc Savage. You can't.
Not stay sane.
No. They're this, because they...
Is it like the same, is it like old pulp novels where it's sort of like the same plot?
Yes. It's not, he didn't, there were ostensibly 181 Doc Savage novels. The reality is there's 9 Doc Savage novels, but there's,
the,
you know.
The names changed.
Yeah, they were all written 9 times.
It's the year before, years before Find and Replace, so they actually put in an effort, you
That's
know?
Just it. I mean, they're breakneck, and they're, you know, they're great, but if you read more than, like, two, yeah, because it's Christmas vacation. I'm chowing these down at the rate of one a day, and then after about 5 days, I'm like, oh my god. I mean, they're great, but they're just not meant to be read.
Over.
Oh, they're not meant to be read in that compressive space. Anyway, but there are 181 Doc Savage novels. 180 of them are exactly the same. The same story over and over and over again. The last one in the series was a little shorter than the rest. They, at that point, they, I think they knew the magazine was ending. This is like 1948, and of course, they were. I'm talking about reprints and trade paper in paperbacks later. But in the last one, instead of trying to catch some villain who has a big super crime, he's going to, you know, corrupt the banking system, or he's going to steal the gold from Fort Knox or whatever. This one's a little offbeat and weird, where someone has escaped from hell. Ostensibly, that's their story. And Doc Savage has to follow him back into hell to find out what's going on. Now, and Doc Savage's attitude the whole time is, he's all science. Like, there's no hell, really. You can't do this. And Doc is also...
But the money's good? Or the money's,
He just does it for adventure. Okay. He does it for adventure. And his feeling is, that scientific curiosity of, interesting, what really is going on behind the scenes here? Like, you know, I've fought other super criminals who can do things like make the sky blue and what it and kill people with a blue with
it's called daylight.
Exactly, called daylight. Kill people with a like a blue, you know, dawn or whatever. And the reality is it's not supernatural powers, it's that the guy's managed to create ozone in great quantities or something, and it chokes people. So it's always the scientific nugget at the bottom. So that's Doc's mm-hmm. quest, is like, what is the scientific nugget at the heart of the supernatural, quote unquote. So in the last one, he's also stoic. Doc is stoic. He doesn't laugh. He's a good guy, but he's not given too much emotion. And he's, you know, your typical 1930s lantern-jawed hero, so he doesn't show fear, he doesn't show anger. He's not an emotional character. So in this last adventure, he ends up tracking this guy back to what ostensibly hell was. And as he gets in there, he's seeing stuff he's never seen before, and it's a great adventure, because he's seeing all this weird topography and these impossible things for which there is no explanation, and it's a horror story. And the further he gets into it, he starts to realize maybe there's something here. And there's a point in the novel where something is chasing Doc back out of hell, and it grabs Doc by the ankle, and the paragraph is, and Doc screamed, and like, holy, he doesn't scream? That must be really scary. And so the denouement of the novel, it's called Up from Earth's Core, is...
Does he ever find out?
That's the beauty of it. Like, at the end, there's all this sort of, you know, it must have been natural gases that gave us hallucinations. That must be what it is. But we can kind of tell that no one is really buying that. So they don't actually ever say what it was. And then they give enough scientific explanation, pseudo-scientific explanation, to give the idea that, well, if it's not, you know, maybe that's really what... But really, we know he found something. That was the best Doc Savage novel for me, because it's off, you know, it's off pattern. And more importantly, that's just really cool. Like, the idea that you can meld science and the supernatural, that you could somehow actually use science or use modern-day exploratory techniques to find the afterlife. So that was really kind of what cued me in this. I wanted to do something about a detective who decides to use science to solve the world's most supernatural question. And
it's almost like an act of faith in the character to look towards science as offering that explanation.
There's also the notion that with 6 months to live, you know, you're clear on some level, while you might not admit it outright, and Catherine is not given to outpourings of emotion, so she doesn't mention this, but really it's pretty obvious. I mean, she wants there to be something. Because if you're, you know, if you're really trained by the scientific method and that's what your whole belief system is wrapped around, then, you know, then we're just bags of chemicals. And then we're like batteries that die. And then that's it. And nothing happens. And I...
You have just, like, dispirited, like, half the listeners
I know.
Of this podcast.
I know.
You're just all, like, kind of staring at the wrist saying, which way is it again?
I know. It's remember, it's down the street, not across the way. And
helpful advice from the Way podcast.
We should
have like a health minute like on NPR. You know what I mean? This has been your health minute by Mark Wade.
That's right.
Arsenic, not lace.
That's
right. This has been your health minute by Mark Wade.
Oh, man. All right. So anyway.
You know, you are really like living up the Mark Wade is evil. Like it's really freed you as a
That's
person.
Right. That's right. The subliminal message in all of these is I want everybody to walk away from the podcast sort of staring off into space and contemplating the futility of their own existence. That's what I want. So join my world. Where were we before the...
Oh, we were talking about...
Cat
being...
So she wants to believe in something. The what intrigues me is that there have been a lot of scientific experiments about what constitutes life after death. I mean, obviously there's... The jury is still a little bit out on life after death experiences, people who die on the operating table and see the white light or something. I've been doing a lot of reading on this, and I don't, without putting on my tinfoil hat and being all conspiracy theory about it, you know, there is no conclusive proof one way or another, but there's still enough evidence that it merits further investigation that there's something to the fact that everybody has a commonality of experience.
If we're going the science route, don't you think that commonality of experience comes out of the fact we're all made by the same basic bits? Mm. I mean, that white light, you know, the common explanation's always been the neurons flashing, and it's by your optic nerve, and you see this light, and you see memories, and you see...
But there's also a slate of experiments that have been done where it's not just the seeing of the white light. It's also that sense of, the old saw about... rising above and sort of seeing your own dead body or whatever and sort of seeing the room. And there's been a lot of, again, entirely likely apocryphal but still worthwhile observations and experiments proving that there are people who have seen things in those visions that they could not possibly have known about, and yet they, like, you know, what was going on in the next room or who was actually in the room at the time. Things that they wouldn't have any other way of knowing, ostensibly. The kind of, you know, being able to describe the room they were in when they quote-unquote died on the operating table, things they would not...
But, I mean, there's also that sort of shared experience. We all watch TV. We all see, you know, how operating table rooms look like.
Right.
Everyone's watched ER or seen... I mean, there are elements of we pick up snippets, we pick up descriptions that all share the same characteristics.
And that is in all likelihood the foundation of all
but
this stuff.
But it's fun to think otherwise.
But it's fun to think... And also, if you have a brain tumor, you got 6 months to live.
Why not
claw at those? You know, I can see why you claw at those straws. There's also been, and more importantly, and this is absolutely true, and this is a big foundation of the first Adventure in the Unknown, 4-issue miniseries premiering in
May
by artist Mink Oosterveer.
Oh, it's so pretty.
He's so good. So, all right, we'll plug it again before the end of the podcast. But one of the things that's been a foundation of this life after death stuff is that there've been long for a while experiments about weighing the body before and after death.
The weight of the soul.
Yeah, 21 grams and so forth. It's all crap. I mean, you go back and you actually look at the experiments that were being done, and they were being done on scales that were made to measure cows. You know, I mean, they're not, this is like 1910, and they're not scientifically accurate. And they're not duplicatable results. But they're at Duke University, they still are working on a variation of this experimentation with the idea that they don't necessarily believe one way or another, but it's worth pursuing because the concept is obviously, you know, energy and matter are related. Obviously, you can't destroy, you know, energy can neither be created or destroyed, just transformed. The idea is if you can measure some energy on, whether it's by weight or by electromagnetic signature, if you can measure anything leaving the human body at the moment of death, then that if something energetic, if something, some energy there changes somehow, that proves that there's something going on. It doesn't prove there's life after death. It doesn't necessarily prove what happens next, but it proves there's something going on. The big stumbling block right now is that on a quantum level, they're theorizing that you would have to be able to measure weight loss to the trillionth of an ounce. And we don't have that capability. We will if we put enough money into it, but there is no other practical application for it. So the scientists at Duke and other scientists around the world are trying to figure out ways to, you know, to create a scale of that,
yeah,
of that sensitivity. That's apparently a key part of the experimentation. So I ran with that, and that became a big part of the unknown. That became they've come across, Catherine and her assistant have come across someone who has actually created something, an instrument that is capable of measuring to that degree, and now it's stolen, and it's being taken somewhere, and we don't know where. But as they follow the track of this thing, they find this other thing that's been stolen, and this other thing, and a bunch of other little artifacts from all over the world, having to deal with reincarnation research or life after death research. And clearly, someone besides Catherine is also interested
in
the answers.
This question.
Or do they want the or?
Are they keeping it from her?
Or keeping someone else from finding out? Because that's part of the problem, too, is that, you know, there are church organizations who actively, and this is true, stand in the way of these kind of experiments because they're
because it's built on faith. And
right.
If you prove
it
one way or the other, it takes away the power of
exactly.
the church.
Because their stated attitude is, well, you know, why bother? Because we all know that there is life after death. When the suspected reality is they're saying, yeah, but if you prove otherwise, we're screwed.
Okay.
So, yeah. So that's the unknown, and I'm really happy about the way it's turning out. So it's that kind of hardcore, weird pulp adventure, you know, around the world madcap chase for big stuff, and it's pretty funny in places, but it's also kind of dark. So,
oh, the pages we've seen so far have just been Mink is like out of this world. The
yeah.
pacing is great. The colors are books.
Storytelling's excellent. He's one of the most talented people I've ever worked with. It's a really good book. We got Paul Pope doing
covers.
We've got
Matthew Dowd Smith.
We've got
a bunch of people.
We've got a lot of good stuff on this, and it premieres in May, 4 issues, and we hope you look for it.
Thanks for listening.
All right, see you next week.